This is ACC CardiaCast, a series on the latest clinical education brought to you by the American College of Cardiology.
Thank you for joining us on this podcast for the ACC program, Cardiovascular Disease and Diabetes, Reducing the Burden. This time we're going to focus on the discussion of monitoring patients that have been started on a new diabetes therapy, for example, an SGLT2 inhibitor or a GLP-1 receptor agonist. What are the things we look for and think about in patients taking these in terms of assessing their tolerance, assessing the benefit they're getting? What changes we might make, especially thinking about clinicians that might be less experienced with these drugs? My name is Michael Blaha. I'm a cardiologist at Johns Hopkins, and I'm joined by Melissa McGuire and Michael Nassif for a discussion here about managing these patients. So we talked in a prior podcast about the risk-benefit analysis of starting one of these therapies, and now we'll take, for example, that we started a patient on one of these therapies, and what do we look for? So let's start about thinking about the GLP-1 receptor agonists, which of course can have some gastrointestinal side effects. Some patients can get some injection site reactions, et cetera. But okay, Melissa, let's say we have a patient that's been started on one of these drugs, maybe at a higher dose. And maybe they come back to you saying they have some side effects. Just walk me through your thinking about how what you're gonna talk to in terms of that patient, and what changes you might make.
Well, the first thing I do is assess the patient as far as maybe some of their eating habits. If they're overeating, they're going to have some symptoms. We know that a side effect of a GLP-1 receptor agonist is to slow down gastric emptying.
Right.
So it makes sense if they overeat that they're going to have this nausea or overly full feeling. We tend to shy away from the word nausea when teaching, and we say overly full, because a lot of folks who haven't had that feeling of cessation or been full kind of equate it with nausea, when really it's not so much nausea, it's just that uncomfortable. Then we also talk to practitioners and say, hey, look, there's no timeline to get to that dose. You know, it started at 0.6 milligrams. It's recommended that you do that for a week and then titrate up. But if you take someone up to 1.2 milligrams and they're having, you know, overtly having a lot more symptoms, you can back down and titrate back down again for another week. It's not a race. It's more of a marathon than a sprint. So you can always pull that dose back down because the pen has all three doses on it. So you can just back titrate down, recounsel again on the eating, and just kind of take it a little slower.
And do you see some reduced side effects when you do that, just titrate down?
Okay. We do. And usually when we see the most side effects, it's those folks that are overeating or who maybe titrated up a little too quickly.
Okay, great. So think about SGLT2 inhibitors for a second. Of course, we think about they have benefits on kidney disease outcomes, but we think about GFR, let's say less than 30, of being a patient population, we don't use these drugs as much. So you think a lot about kidney disease and heart failure and these drugs. What about, tell us to think about monitoring GFR, or what we do if the GFR changes when patients are on these therapies.
Yeah, and one thing, it's very similar to ACE inhibitors, that in all the randomized trials thus far, when you start the drugs, everyone has an initial decrease in the GFR.
That's a great point.
I mean, it's likely similar to ACE inhibitors. It's likely a protective effect, decreased filtration across the glomeruli. But there have been open label reports to the FAERS database of acute kidney injury. But what's interesting is it hasn't been shown in any of the outcomes trials, in any of the randomized controlled trials. The doubling of creatinine or requiring dialysis or acute kidney injury has always been statistically significantly less.
With in the benefit direction, right.
And empagliflozin. I think there is a theoretical risk of volume depletion. So if somebody was dehydrated to start and you were to start an SGLT2 inhibitor, I think you could be concerned about volume depleting them to a degree. In the CANVAS study with canagliflozin, they did have a non-statistically significant increase in volume depletion, but in the EMPA-REG outcomes trial, they saw identical volume depletion with placebo.
So did you do any special kind of monitoring of their labs on the medicine?
I think,
or just kind of
very similar to like when cardiologists start ACE inhibitors. Make sure you obviously have a baseline, a basic metabolic panel, and then make sure you have a follow-up within, 2 to 4 weeks.
We always do a little bit of education with patients too regarding dehydration and just avoiding dehydration, and especially in the hotter summer months, making sure that they realize that if they're on an SGLT2, that they are going to need maybe a little bit more volume and try to avoid some of the dehydration to mitigate some of that.
Yeah, that's a great point. So my understanding is really the signal about pancreatitis with GLP-1 receptor agonist has not really shown up in the clinical trials. It's more of a theoretical concern, I think, at this point. But anything, do you do anything in terms of monitoring or thinking about or talking to your patients about that? Or really that's off the table right now when you think about GLP-1 receptor agonist therapy?
Well, we do counsel all patients, really actually with any new type 2 diabetic medication, you're going to see that in the package insert.
Yeah.
And when you're working with that core group of patients, we know that type 2 diabetics are at higher risk for pancreatitis. It makes sense that they saw some of that in the trial. What we do in the real world is simply, you know, educate that this has been seen or may be seen, to report any irretractable vomiting, any really substantial abdominal pain. You know, there for a while in the package label of liraglutide, it said not to give with someone who had had a history of pancreatitis. That's since been taken out.
Right, good point.
Because they have not seen, moving forward with you know, millions of lives on the drug, this signal coming out. Just use caution. If I had somebody who was a type 2 diabetic out of control, an alcoholic with triglycerides of 600, that may not be a patient that I would want to start a GLP-1 receptor agonist on.
Great, great point. And one of the benefits, I should say, of these therapies, both of them, these classes of therapies, is, I should say, non-glycemic beneficial effects, right? A little bit of blood pressure lowering, you might see. Of course, we talked about the weight loss. Mm-hmm. And other metrics of kind of even anti-inflammatory effects, right? Not necessarily things that we measure in practice, but things that we expect to see and maybe part of the benefit of the drug. So I guess I'll toss it to you for kind of a final thought on, you know, I guess, what are the future of these drugs in terms of thinking about monitoring them? I mean, you know, since they have some kind of off-target effects, I mean, you're familiar with the ongoing trials. Kind of anything else that's coming down the line in terms of monitoring kind of the non-glycemic effects of these drugs?
Yeah, I think in terms of monitoring, I think kind of one of the questions remaining is patients seem to get a degree of hemoconcentration. So in every single SGLT2 study, patients have had an increase of their hematocrit of 2 to 3%. And there's been some concern that all major trials thus far have had a non-significant but a trend toward increased stroke and TIA. So I think it will be interesting as we get a large number of patients randomized over a number of years to see if this hemoconcentration does end up having any problems with stroke.
I'll be curious to see what, for example, what proBNP, for example, does. I'm sure they'll be measuring that in the future heart failure studies. Because that mechanism, like we talked about, the mechanism is not so clear about why it has so much cardioprotective benefit or heart failure reduction. But hey, you know, it's interesting.
There was a very small sample from Canvas trial that they were able to look at NT-proBNP, and they were normal at baseline because these patients predominantly did not have heart failure. But what they saw is the patients on canagliflozin, their NT-proBNP stayed stable, while the patients on placebo had increased over time.
Right, so we had a stabilization effect there.
But we'll be
and my understanding, right, Musa, is that I think GLP-1 receptor agonists could lead to a slight increase in the heart rate.
Generally,
but probably not important, right?
Really haven't seen the significance of that. It's usually up to about 5 beats per minute. Mm-hmm. I do know that they are continuing to look at that in further studies, but have not really seen a clinical significance as yet at that.
Great.
I would caution a little bit, liraglutide in particular, the FIGHT study that the NHLBI Heart Failure Network put on. And granted, these were patients with significant symptomatic heart failure, mostly NYHA3 patients with recent decompensation. But there was trends toward liraglutide having harm in that population. And one of the theories potentially is, and heart failure is well known, that increased heart rate.
Yes.
So maybe a little hesitation, just in these advanced heart failure patients. Decompensated, Great. Well, great discussion. I find this extremely helpful, hopefully helpful all to the practicing clinicians out there thinking about using these drugs or maybe getting experience using these drugs and just what to think about and what to talk to our patients about. So thanks for joining us on this ACC program podcast as part of the ongoing series, Cardiovascular Disease and Diabetes, Reducing the Burden. And do join us for some of the other podcasts and videos that are part of this series. Thank you.
This has been the ACC Cardiacast, your latest education from the American College of Cardiology. Go to acc.org to find this and other additional resources related to today's show.